From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week, an Israeli film festival, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and a longtime cantor's story. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? Don't miss a word right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Word association time. If I say damsel, I'd be willing to bet you'll fill in distress. Artist Jenny Montgomery wants you to reframe the idea of damsels, as we'll learn a bit later on in today's show. But first, for 38 years, Janice Rogers served as cantor for Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation. On her retirement, Indianapolis Business Journal arts and entertainment editor Lou Harry spoke with Cantor Rogers about her pioneering work in what was predominantly a male field, the role of music in Jewish services, and her duet with Ben Vereen.
When you came to Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation 38 years ago, what was it like for a woman cantor? Was there a degree of skepticism about that?
Well, in general, there was a degree of skepticism because IHC had never had someone that they hired as a cantor. They had had a music director, Farrell Scott, for decades. And then they hired a gentleman who was actually a cantor by the name of Stephen Richards, who was hired as their music director and youth director. And then he left, and actually he became my teacher. And they got another music director. But when Rabbi Jonathan Stein was installed as the rabbi, he said he wanted to have a cantor. And so people didn't quite know what to make of it. Probably being a woman made it a little easier because there wasn't that, I don't know, competition, male-male thing.
You weren't going to be the vice rabbi.
Right, exactly. So I think that might have made it a little easier.
Okay.
But it was my dream job because there was a wonderful music program that had been started by Steve Richards. There was a choir. There were professional singers. There was a beautiful organ and a wonderful organist who played every week. So it was a great place for me to be.
For those who don't really know, what could you sort of define the role of the cantor, and does that change from congregation to congregation?
Well, let me give you the elevator speech. The cantor is part music director, part pastor, and part chief soloist, as well as a teacher. And that's pretty much the way things are in most congregations. However, some congregations see their cantors as speakers as well. And the American Cantor Conference of Cantors, of which I am a member, has been trying since its inception, which was a long time ago, to really make sure that people understood that cantors are full clergy partners in their congregations.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit about the musical demands. I know, whether you call it performing, it's not performing, it's being part of the service, mm-hmm. but you probably have had a larger musical audience than just about any performer in Indianapolis and reached more people. Tell us about the musical and vocal demands of the job.
Well, because it's not like an opera where you sing and sing and sing and sing for an hour or so, mm-hmm. Vocally it's not a demanding job, at least I haven't found it to be. Although I do have to say that it's been important to me to continue studying voice through my tenure. For the first few years I was here, I didn't study voice. And then all of a sudden I realized, once when I had laryngitis for 2 weeks, that I had better study voice. And I found a wonderful teacher, John Schmid, who happens to be the chorus master for Indianapolis Opera. And he worked with me in very much the same vein as my previous voice teacher had, my New York voice teacher had, and it's been very, very simple. There have been times when it's been more challenging to sing, but vocally, it's definitely not like singing with a symphony orchestra or singing in an opera. So I felt it's very reasonable.
Is the opportunities for women cantors different now than they were 38 years ago?
I would say so, especially because more women have gone to school to become cantors, have taken coursework independently to become cantors. So whereas 40 years ago, where you could count on both hands the number of female cantors in the United States, especially ones who had been seminary trained, now in our organization, they're telling me that about 55% of the members are women.
Oh. Well, have there been temptations along the way or desires to perform elsewhere?
One of the things I instituted at IHC was the Second Sunday Concert Series. And we would have about six concerts over the course of the school year. And there would be all kinds of different things. And generally, I would take one of those concerts.
Okay.
So I've done, well, my last concert was called The Musical Zoo, where I did classical music that was all about animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done, I did a concert of composers whose last names all began with P, and All in the Family, husbands, wives, sisters, fathers, sons, who mm-hmm. were composers, and their music. So I've been able to actually carve out any desire I have to sing not Jewish music. I found a place for it myself.
And I was privileged to be in the audience when you joined Ben Vereen on stage at one point doing some singing.
Well, that was incredibly impromptu.
Mm-hmm.
We used to host a series called the Block Forum, and Ben Vereen was one of the guests, and the chairperson of the Block Forum series happened to be a big fan of mine, and she said, If he was willing, would you sing with Ben Vereen? And I'm like, if he was willing, would I sing with Ben Vereen? You know, is the Pope Catholic, as they say? Of course. And yeah. We had a lovely duet.
It was a treasure.
And I have a wonderful picture of that.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the musical repertoire and how that's changed in the services over the years. Is it, 90% what it was 40 years ago? Are things... are the times a-changing in the music we hear?
The times, they have a-changed.
Okay.
I grew up in a Reformed congregation in Chicago, and our music was in kind of two fields. What I would call classical Jewish music, which is music that was actually composed for the synagogue by classically trained Jewish composers, and then arrangements of traditional chants. So that's what I grew up with. When I came to IHC, the tradition they had was very much that classical Jewish synagogue music. We have a library full of it still, because I wouldn't throw it away. It's a treasure trove. We did a lot of that. And then we began to incorporate traditional prayer chants that the congregation could participate in. And over the last probably 15 to 20 years, we've begun to include more contemporary music. We do what I call our services now is they're very eclectic. So we have some traditional. I try to throw in some traditional cantorial chant. We have the traditional prayer chants, but we also have music composed within the last 10 years or so, even less than that, even newer than that. So it's really changed a lot, and I'd say that probably 50% of what I programmed when I first came to IHC, I haven't done in 20 years.
Contributor Lou Harry with cantor Janice Roger, who recently retired after 38 years with Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation. If you grew up with The Little Mermaid, Tinkerbell, Cinderella, or any of a multitude of other female Disney characters, you have deep memories of somewhat sylph-like, delicate damsels. Artist Jenny Montgomery looks at these characters a bit differently, and I invited her to tell me how her Anti-Damsel series of drawings got started.
How did Anti-Damsels start?
Well, it actually started with, I had an idea for a children's book. I wanted to do this sort of inspiring, strong female character, and it ended up being more work than I wanted to do. So I just decided I was going to start doodling and converting fairy tale princesses into like a modern day woman seemed like a cool thing to do.
And who was the first one you did?
The first one was actually Tinkerbell. And I turned her into a voodoo priestess holding Peter Pan's eyeball. So it was a little, it's not exactly what I'm doing now, but it was a start.
That's very dark. I love that. And how do you, is it, let me think how to ask this. Is it a visual art decision or an intellectual slash emotional decision what direction you go when you start with the fairy tale character?
So that's a really good question. I'd say it's about half and half. Sometimes I look at these coloring pages and there's something in the posture that I say, oh, I could turn this figure into this kind of person. Mm-hmm. Other times I have an idea of who I want to portray. So when I drew Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I looked for someone that I could turn into her specifically.
Oh, and you have to tell us who it was.
Oh, it was just, actually I can't remember. It might have been Cinderella.
Oh,
I think it was Cinderella.
Oh, I love that. So I'm going to, because we're talking just with our voices about visual art, I'm going to ask you to take one of the examples that you brought with you and tell us about the fairy tale character and then what you've done with her or him.
Okay, so my Water is Life image is of a Standing Rock Sioux protester. And the original image is an old rendering of Cinderella where she, I don't know what she's doing. I think she's just fluffing her hair. But this was one where I saw the posture with her hands sort of up to her face, and it looked like she could be yelling. So I turned her into a protester, changed the posture, put her in some cool reflective Ray-Bans, and just gave her a whole new twist.
And she's holding a placard that says?
Water is life.
Hmm. When you display your works, do you put the fairy tale character side by side with your interpretation?
I do, and they're a mirror image. So I print the mirror image, I draw on the other one. So it's almost like they are a reflection of each other when they're side by side.
Ah, and where did that idea come from?
I don't know. Honestly, I didn't start out that way, but then I thought it would be more interesting visually, you know, at an art show to see them facing each other.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of the responses you've had from people who are seeing your work for the first time.
I know a lot of my female friends have found this very empowering when they felt sort of frustrated in recent months. A friend of mine actually said, and he's a man, these are giving me life right now.
So oh, my gosh.
That was just the highest compliment for me.
Congratulations. That's remarkable.
Thanks.
No matter what kind of art.
Yeah.
Tell me about some characters that you'd love to interpret and you just haven't found the right fairy tale character to jump off from yet.
So one I really want to do, who I've always admired, is Amelia Earhart. And I did find an image of her, an actual photograph, that I wanted to sort of play off of. But I also want to be careful about not stealing historical photographs and turning them into something else. So it's sort of a dicey area with intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
So I will have to interpret her image in my own way and not really work from a photo.
Are there, conversely, on the other side of the coin, are there cartoon characters that you're kind of fascinated by but you haven't quite figured out who the contemporary mirror image is yet?
You know, not really. I just kind of cast a wide net and look at what's out there and see if I can turn them into something else. So I'm really looking for simplicity, not a lot of background, not a lot of extra characters, so that I can really fill it all in myself.
You can see Jenny Montgomery's anti-damsel drawings at Indie Reads Books during most of July, and you can meet her at an artist reception on July 7th. Can't wait? Search Instagram and anti-damsel online. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and later this hour, Jackie Evancote grows up. But first, it's no secret that the restaurant business is tough, and standing out to attract customers requires great food, but so much more. Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger recently talked with Young & Larimore's Charlie Hopper about his new book called Selling Eating.
Tell me a little bit about your background, especially when it comes to restaurant marketing.
Sure. I've never had a job other than writing ads. I have only written ads, and one of the places for 18 years our agency worked with Steak and Shake, locally based company, grew it from Steak and Shake of the 80s. That, you know, they had a footprint, but they had kind of shrunk up a little bit to, you know, late 2000s. They were kind of starting to get really, you know, everywhere. That was a real education, just going through, you know, starting as another set of ad guys, just doing another account, to learning the restaurant business, which turns out to be, in my experience, the most complicated business there is.
There's tell me why.
So many ways for things to go wrong.
Well,
there's
yeah.
so many different moving parts, as you would say. There's the product changes from moment to moment. The delivery of the product isn't consistent. There isn't a lot of control over the human factor. There's all kinds of marketing issues. You know, they operate with limited marketing funds, no matter how big they are. And so there's always this idea that your ad has to outsmart the other ads out there. And if it's not an ad, you know, if it's a way of presenting the food, the name of the food, the way the menu reads, everything has to be calculated to be the most efficient communication possible. And there's just a rhythm to it that is kind of exciting, and it can be overwhelming at times, but
right.
it can be very invigorating to just see the results. If you communicate in an effective way, then people show up and they buy, in this case, burgers. And it's really exciting to see that happen.
You do have a very interesting flow chart in the book about whether a restaurant should exist.
Yeah, should you exist?
Should you exist, or perhaps not? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was just a way of visually expressing, I would say, the first part of the book, because the book flows in a certain pattern, which is to start by examining yourself and imagining, you know, why you should exist and what's your position against the other places and all that. Thinking about very fundamental stuff. Who are you and why are you here? About the chart also contains a little bit of silliness. But it's generally, I think, pretty useful, too, to think of your restaurant, if you are a restaurateur listening, in terms of, you know, why are we here? Why does this restaurant exist?
What do you do? Do you do something that's different than everybody else?
Right.
And then if yes, you go to this route. If no, well, then are you inexpensive? You know, and then you do the same thing as everybody else, but you're cheaper.
And I haven't yet discovered, and there might be local examples that are so specific and unique that they would not fit onto the chart, but I have yet to figure out a restaurant that doesn't fit somewhere in that flow chart and get to exist or don't exist.
Right.
I don't want to say that all museum restaurants are bad, but there are many that are very expensive, serving very average food. But look where they are.
There's nothing else around them.
That's
are
right.
there, are so, there any other options close by you? No? Well, okay. Then maybe you have that. Maybe that's an advantage, right?
Right. But then you get those very unique restaurants that are in a location, and I'm thinking of the one up in Perkinsville that we like to take people
Bongies,
to
at
the Bongies. Why do we drive so far to go to Bongies?
Right?
Every time we take somewhere there, because you have to be taken there the first time. You can't find it on your own because it goes on longer than you expect and it's way out there. But then you show up and it's just marvelous. And
right.
Everything
so
about it is
so it,
well done.
So it is unique. It doesn't have anything else around it. And it's serving good food. And it has the atmosphere. Those are some of the things that you touch on in the flowchart.
Almost any restaurant probably fits onto that chart. Once you kind of get through it and think about it, then you can start to say, now that I kind of understand why it exists, how can I communicate that? Because that's the problem, is that a lot of places really understand who they are. When you're in there, you get it.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. To the Art of the Matter, I'm Sharon Gamble. Like everyone else in America, Indianapolis audiences have fallen in love with Jackie Evancho. The world discovered her when she was just 10 and appeared on, well, stole the show on, America's Got Talent. She's 17 now, and she recently made her second concert appearance at the Center for the Performing Arts, and Jill Dittmeyer got to spend some time with Jackie.
It's really hard to believe that she's only 17. I mean, her voice still is that of someone who's just much more mature and seems like she's had decades of experience and training. But after speaking with her on the phone, I can definitely tell you that her spirit is most definitely that of a teenager. She still lives with her parents and her siblings in Pittsburgh. And the afternoon that I called her, she had just returned from a drive in her brand new car. That's a sporty Mazda. She told me she bought it herself after she got her driver's license earlier this year. And, of course, like most teenagers, she was thrilled at the independence of having her own set of wheels.
For me, it is a little different just because I can kind of have a moment to myself when I'm in the car and take myself places. Because, I mean, it's not just me who gets tired from the travel. It's my parents, too, and they're the ones who have to take me everywhere. So,
now, do you have specific music that you like to listen to in the car?
I listen to everything from some rap songs, actually, to classical music, to bands like the Black Keys, stuff like that.
And I also know that you just had a birthday recently, too.
Right.
My birthday is actually April the 9th as well.
Oh, happy birthday, late birthday.
I know. It's kind of fun. We're Aries, aren't we?
Yeah.
Now, were you getting ready for the Carlisle performances on your birthday, or did you get to celebrate your birthday?
Kind of both. I had already been at the Carlisle. Oh, actually, no. I left for the Carlisle the day after my birthday. So I was enjoying my birthday, but at the same time, keeping the mentality that I'd be doing something that was a big deal for me.
And it was a big deal. Tell me about that experience for you. What was that like for you?
It was a lot different than what I'm used to. To have such a small audience was a lot different. It's kind of a whole different atmosphere. And to do that, I thought I was going to be scared out of my mind. But in reality, I ended up enjoying it a lot. And it was just so comfortable and carefree for me. I would definitely do it again.
Did you have to change the way you presented your songs or the songs that you selected, or how did you make that accommodation?
I created a whole new show for the Carlisle, because why not? It's a brand new experience for me, so why not go in with a new mentality, new show, kind of everything. And so I changed how much I spoke, the songs that I sang, and kind of created a really nice environment.
And did you leave that situation with a whole new confidence and maybe a kind of a vision for at least the next year or so for you?
Actually, yes. Doing the Carlisle, it really kind of gave me a new confidence in my voice. And actually, right after I changed my show, too, changed things up a little bit. It put new songs in and stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of inspired me a lot.
And did you present some songs off your new album for the Carlisle then, too?
Yes. I did some songs that I actually have never recorded, and then I did some that were from my new album, like The Way We Were, Pedestal, Caruso, those songs.
And I understand that you wrote some songs on Two Hearts as well.
Right. Actually, Pedestal is one song that I wrote. I wrote Same Pedestal, Wonderland, and The Haunting.
Tell me why you decided to write your own music, and what's your process when you're writing your songs?
I had always written music, and I'd always been a little too afraid to show anyone, so I was kind of pushed by my parents a little bit in a good way, the kind of necessary push, nothing that made me uncomfortable, but I ended up working with two people, Heather Holly and Dina Fanai, and we kind of just sat in a room, talked about our lives and kind of merged ideas, and I started writing down ideas on paper, and they were playing around with the piano, and we all just kind of merged our ideas.
Now, are you still writing music right now, or are you just trying to focus on your tour?
Right now, I'm focusing on the tour, but I have had some inspiration moments and wrote, but nothing serious, just little lines.
I'm going to guess that driving in that car is going to elicit some new inspirational songs for you too, maybe, huh?
Oh, definitely. It already has a little bit. I see the world in a whole new adult-like perspective, you know? So that's inspirational.
And what is it that you want to do with your voice? How do you want to grow your voice when it comes to music and expression?
I kind of want to have my own place in the music world. I don't want to follow footsteps of anybody else. I kind of just want to create my own path because I feel that it's been such a long time since that's happened. And I really just kind of, I don't know, want to make my own mark.
And I know a lot of people, when you sang at the inauguration and with your sister, a lot of people perhaps are wondering if, you know, if you're going to start taking some kind of a political stand or stand up more for LGBT rights or that kind of thing. Are those things important to you, or how important are they to you and with your own career?
Those things are actually very important to me. Not politics. I try my best to stay out of politics as much as possible, but when it comes to my family and people living lives where they're not judged and they can just be themselves, as long as it doesn't harm anybody else, then why not let it happen? And so for me, it's just about acceptance. And especially whenever it comes to my family, it's something I will always be passionate about.
And do you have any desires to use your music in any other forms, as in, you know, musical theater or teaching or anything like that? Or is it mainly performance and albums? Or
it's mainly performance and albums, but I think it'd be cool to be Christine on Broadway for The Phantom of the Opera. That's about it.
And why that role?
Because that's my inspiration. That's kind of what started my love for singing, was actually the movie The Phantom of the Opera.
And as she mentioned in the interview, she really likes singing in that cabaret style. So I told her, Sharon, we have a really wonderful cabaret style venue here in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And perhaps Jackie should come back again. So maybe she will. And, you know, I think anybody would be nuts if they do put up another reproduction of Phantom of the Opera to not get her in there as Christina, which would be extraordinary to see her in that role.
Absolutely. With luck. And now she knows her way to Indianapolis. So
yes.
Maybe she'll make an annual stop here or more.
Let's hope so.
Well, speaking of nice arts things we get to watch going by day and week by week, we have some other offerings on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
It's Zoolapalooza season, Sharon. It started. It's June, so we have to head to the zoo. We
okay.
go to the zoo all the time, but on Friday nights now through July the 14th, from 5:30 to 8:30, this is when they have different bands every Friday night. They have food, they have beer, they still have the animals. You can get the whole full deal, but this is kind of more for the grown-ups there. It's a really fun event, and you can go to the IndianapolisZoo.com, their website, to see the list of the bands and to see what's on the menu on that Friday night.
Well, at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, on most Saturday mornings this summer at 10 o'clock, you can do yoga with a registered yoga instructor from Indianapolis. You can stretch your limbs and realign your mind, body, and spirit while being surrounded by inspiring art and nature across campus. I was out there not too long ago pulling some weeds as part of a volunteer gig and looked over and saw a yoga class having an amazing time. And while the IMA isn't suggesting this, I will suggest that not far from where you're doing your yoga is the beer garden, so you might want to reward yourself.
Carb reloading.
That's
after
it.
After unwinding.
Bingo. And you know what? We have lots more things to do, but I think we're out of time.
I think we are, but if you need to find out more, you can look it up online at theindiearts.org/guide. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Arts Guide. Or we'll be back next week with our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. The JCC has organized its second annual Israeli Film Festival for July 8th through the 13th, and I invited the JCC's Director of Arts and Education, Lev Rothenberg, and co-organizer, Israeli emissary Inbar Nadir, to tell us about the films, which run the gamut of subject matter. So, Lev, this is just the second year. Can you remind us of kind of the mission of this film festival?
Yes. What we want to do is build bridges and to represent the diversity and creativity of Israel through film.
Mm-hmm. That makes great sense. And there aren't that many opportunities in Indianapolis, with the exception of maybe a couple of commercial movie theaters that will screen films. But you have a chance to get way beyond that mass market, right?
Exactly. We've spent a lot of time. We've looked at many, many films. We've done a lot of networking to come up with just the right six films that you're not going to see anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Inbar, how did you get involved?
So I think that my role here in the community is basically what brought me into this project. I'm the Israeli Shlicha, or the Israeli emissary in Greater Indianapolis, which basically means that my main job here is to bring Israel to the community. And when we're talking about the community, it's not only the Jewish community, but it's the community at large. One of the projects that I've been working on ever since I got to Indiana, actually, is the Israeli Film Festival.
Fantastic. And I know, I fear we don't have time to talk about all of them in depth, but I'm so intrigued by your first day where you have two films that seem thematically linked to me and a chance for people to buy dinner and discuss between the two films. Let's talk about how you chose. Give me a brief summary of those films and why you think they go together.
Absolutely. So the first film is actually a family-friendly feature. It's called Abulele. And it tells the story of a young boy that unfortunately lost his brother. And after being bullied at school, he finds comfort in a magical friend.
Uh-huh.
The film was inspired by the film E.T., and you can see both live actors and some animation.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And the interesting thing there, I don't think we ever saw in the Israeli cinema a film like that before. It gives a very heartwarming feeling at the end of the film. One thing that is very much important to mention is that the film is all in Hebrew, and if you're bringing your children, which you should, they should be able to read subtitles in English.
Sure.
The second film is family-friendly as well. It's called My Hero Brother, and it tells the story about a group of siblings who are taking their brothers and sisters with Down syndrome to a once-in-a-lifetime journey up to the Himalaya from India. This film is a documentary. I watched it four times up until now.
Oh, my gosh.
And I cried every time that I watched it because it was so emotional. And so it's real life. That's just what it is. And
I can just imagine the dinner conversation, or the conversation for that matter after the second film, people talking about, well, what challenges have you had? Because that's the thematic link. No
Absolutely.
Life is smooth. Obstacles in every life. And how you deal with them is what makes you succeed.
Absolutely. I think that usually when you see films that are featuring Israel and featuring Israeli society, usually you see things about the conflict, but you don't talk about the actual society that lives in Israel, the actual culture. And those two films are dealing with global issues within families, within societies. And I think that's what's unique about them in this arena.
Speaking of global issues, we have to talk about hummus, the movie. Everybody loves to eat, and it sounds charming.
Oh, absolutely. So hummus, the movie, it will be the fourth film that we'll show. And basically, we have an issue. Hummus is not only a dish, but it has a whole history, a whole culture behind it. And all three religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, they all claim hummus, but no one really owns it. And we can see three, in the film we'll be able to see three hummus makers, one Israeli Jewish smiley guy, the other one is a Muslim unmarried woman that calls the hummus her children. And third is a young Christian Arab from Israel, again, who wants to take the challenge of making hummus not only a local production, but take it to Europe and spread the word and love of hummus.
That is fantastic.
And, of course, we will have hummus and wine that evening.
I was going to say, you have to. That's a requirement.
Absolutely. What's unique about this year's festival is we'll have several more events. Lev, would you like to expand about that?
Well, of course, we've got the wine tasting and hummus. And Inbar will also be interviewing a gentleman.
Yes, Mr. Moran Bierman, who is the consul for public diplomacy at the Israeli Consulate to the Midwest that is located in Chicago.
Israeli emissary Inbar Nadir and JCC Indy Director of Arts and Education Lev Rothenberg. The second annual Israeli Film Festival features six Israeli films in 5 days from July 9th through the 13th. Don't speak Hebrew? Don't worry. All films are subtitled, and lots of special events are in the works, including some chances to break bread together. You can buy tickets for individual films or get a discounted pass, and all films will be screened in the Lakin Auditorium at the JCC. Learn lots more at jccindy.org/Israeli-film-fest. What makes a monster and what makes a man? That's the core question at the center of the musical The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Bob Direct's Bob Harbin is producing this challenging piece June 23rd through July 9th at the Marion University Theater. I invited Bob to talk about the slightly dark subject matter and how he motivates his cast members. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the musical.
Yes, ma'am.
I love that the president of Walt Disney Theatrical mentioned that it embraces darker elements.
It does. They have gone away from the animated feature that came out, I think it was 96, mm-hmm. maybe.
And the musical stage play dates to just 2 or 3 years after that, right?
Right. But since that time, there was a German version that was very dark. But what they've done is gone back to the original Victor Hugo novel, Victor Les Mis,
yeah.
You know, Hugo novel. And they've tried to make it, I guess, a little more realistic. The feature film is adorable. You know, Tom Hulce is the voice of Quasimodo. And there's a goat. I mean, please. A movie with a goat, you can't lose, you know. And the three the gargoyles are there for comic relief, and it's very entertaining. However, I think even in that, the character of Frollo is scary. I mean, many people have said that he's one of the, if not the scariest Disney villain, because he's so real.
Yeah, he's kind of the ultimate anti-hero, the ultimate villain.
And so they have gone back to a lot of the original story, the music is taken from that score, which was nominated for an Academy Award. The music just soars. It's beautiful, and it's all about the underdog and what makes a monster, what makes a man. And we really get to see that it's not all cut and dry, you know, that many times the people you expect to trust are not trustworthy at all. So from that point of view, it's a masterful work. And when you think that that this archdeacon who took Quasimodo in and then gives him the name Quasimodo, which means half formed.
And why did he take him in? Let's remind people.
Well,
why,
in the
what
book,
his
it was,
was.
You know, I think, you know, it was one of those left on a doorstep kind of things, and mm-hmm. and an exchange with Esmeralda as an infant, And but in our story, his brother, Frollo's brother, Jehan, they were both taken into the church. Jehan said, "This is not for. I'm an adventurer. I want to have excitement in my life. I want to do things." And Frollo took to the teachings of the church and became very strict. So Jehan goes out and unfortunately gets a little case of smallpox. And from the gypsies, you know, because he takes up with a gypsy woman, and as he's dying, he asks his brother to take care of his son, who is Quasimodo, and so Frollo agrees to do this, but he can't let go of the fact that a gypsy cursed my brother, you know, mm-hmm. so to speak. And then, of course, we find out that the gypsies aren't as evil or awful as, you know, as we tend to think. But gypsies have gotten an awfully bad rap through the years, don't you think?
And that's what's nice about a good book. You find out that life starts out black and white and ends up a million shades of gray.
It surely does. And this wonderful, wonderful character that this story is built around, who is kept in a bell tower, you know, his whole life, and then all of a sudden has the guts to step outside and try a little bit of life, and then gets shut down, you know, immediately. And then, of course, you have your hero, and you have your your good-looking captain of the guard, and the love triangle between, you know, him and Esmeralda and Quasimodo, and then, you know, the archbishop doesn't turn out to be such a nice guy. So there's love and death and humor and through it all, some of the most amazing music that I think Alan Menken has ever written. And he's certainly, the score from Beauty and the Beast is just, you know, incredible.
Talk to me about Quasimodo, about how much of the physical deformity is prosthetic and how much is acting.
Through the year, there have been, you know, several films. The Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
Version is a sort of famous film with Maureen O'Hara mm-hmm. playing Esmeralda, which doesn't seem very. I never found her very sexy. I always thought she was very handsome and great with John Wayne, but I don't know. And Anthony Quinn, you know, played the part in an Italian version. Gina Lollobrigida played Esmeralda, and I think. In a film situation, they were trying to present this character as ugly and as deformed as they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, you know, god-awful humps, and Charles Laughton, you know, had half of his face looked like it melted, and everybody talk like this. And so
it was of its time and place now.
So in our particular production, if that's your question, he does, of course, have a hump. But rather than prosthetics, which I think no matter how good they are, but they tend to, you know, you sweat and they tend to flake and look like prosthetics.
Yeah.
So we've got, I think, a very inventive way to present a man who looks deformed, but but we're not going to lay it on thick to convince you. I think it's more important that as an audience we have some room to imagine our own deformities than to spell it out.
I had the sense you might end up at that place. Favorite moment in the show?
Oh, gee. There's several tearjerker moments. I think my favorite moment is when Esmeralda finds Quasimodo at the fair, and they're having a contest that's called the King of Fools, and there's every year apparently there was this festival, and they would pick the ugliest person at the festival to be the King of Fools, and they would have that for that day. They would reign over this festival, And she sees Quasimodo, and she just thinks that he's wearing a mask. And she says, "Oh, gee, you should, you know, enter the contest. You'll be great." And she sees then that it's not a mask; that it's his actual face. And I think, like so many of us in our lifetimes, we've had that moment. You can go forward, or you can retreat and make it an ugly moment. And she goes forward and becomes his friend. And I just think that's, to me, is the most unique and wonderful moment.
Bob Harbin is producer and director of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which you can see June 23rd through July 9th at the Marion University Theater. The production is family-friendly and might lead to conversations about love, acceptance, and how we define our heroes. Learn more at bobdirex.com, and that's bobdirex.com. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined via telephone by JP, the vocalist and guitarist for Surfer Blood. Surfer Blood will be performing in Indianapolis this Sunday, June 18th, at the Hi-Fi. And you can go to HiFiIndy.com to purchase advanced tickets.
Sometimes he just wants attention, crying out just like a child.
And JP, thank you so much for joining us today. And
happy to be here, man. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, Surfer Blood has made a couple records for the Indianapolis label Joyful Noise, and your latest LP, Snowdonia, is out now on Joyful Noise. And Surfer Blood in the past has recorded for Sire Records, and I'm sure you guys must have a lot of options on where you can take your music. So I'm curious, what attracted you to Joyful Noise?
We met the guys from Joyful Noise. Carl came to our show in Cincinnati. We were working on a record without a label and just kind of like feeling it out, and they just seem to have a lot of really good ideas, and you know, there's a lot of really creative people that work there. So yeah, they've taken really good care of us, and they've been really smart about, you know, how to promote our record stuff. So I think it's a really good fit.
And JP, you were kind enough to share five songs with us today. And how would you frame these? Are these five favorite songs, just five things you're just listening to at the moment?
Let's just do five all-time favorite songs. For my first favorite song of all time, I'm going to go with a song called Gold Sounds by the band Pavement.
Mm.
This is a band that I was really, really into in high school and still listen to all the time. Before that, I was listening to a lot of sort of like more punk and like hardcore music, and it was Pavement and Dinosaur Jr. who were the two bands who made me decide that I wanted to write more melodic music.
Now, I keep my address to yourself.
Number two song, I'm going to go with a song by a band called The Clientele called I Had to Say This off their album Suburban Light. This is hands down my favorite record of all time. There's something so dreamy and mysterious and eerie about the record, you know. It sort of toes that line between being really beautiful and creepy, kind of. It does it really, really well.
Number three?
For number three, I'm going to go with a song by a band called Broadcast called Goodbye Girls. I'm a fan of all the synth sounds on this record, and, you know, we're a guitar band, so we don't do too many synths. All the synth sounds on this record are really grainy, like really weird, not typical sounds, and her vocal production is just absolutely phenomenal.
And number four.
For number four, I'm going to go with a song by T-Rex called Monolith, the wah pedal solo in it, which is, you know, kind of cheesy by a lot of people's standards, but we actually ended up trying to copy it on our most recent album, Snowdonia. If you listen to the song Six Flags and Effigy, that wah guitar sound that we're going for is actually trying to emulate this song.
The throne of time
And just a reminder, we're talking to JP of Surfer Blood. And JP, you have one more favorite song to share with us. What's your fifth and final selection?
The Strokes, Hard to Explain. This song was everything to me when I was really young. I think The Strokes are kind of the band that made me want to start playing music in the first place. I remember hearing Is This It when I was in the ninth grade. And I just didn't know that you could make music like that.
And a quick reminder, Surfer Blood will be performing in Indianapolis on Sunday, June 18th at the Hi-Fi. You can go to hifiindy.com to purchase advanced tickets, and you can go to surferblood.com to purchase music or learn more about the band. And JP, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing these songs. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer and Lou Harry. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, a new small studio session from Richard Edwards, how and why to become a playwright in residence, and what's a glue stick festival? And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.